Session number 15433.
Peter McAleese, side 14. And just one thing I was wondering about that was that there were all prisoners and all the rest of it in Namibia and so forth. I mean, they were, even at that time, I mean, there were people charged with atrocities, for want of a better word.
Yes.
What sort of stuff was going on there with them? And
I never actually witnessed anything like that. You know, the, in fairness to the South African now, that compared with Rhodesia, you know, the restraint on the troops was far greater. If we caught any prisoners, we were handed across to security police and they dealt with anything that after that. There was never a close, you know, liaison with us and them as it was in Rhodesia. It was far closer in Rhodesia. But the troops on the ground were given an awful lot of leeway. More leeway
in Rhodesia
rather than in South Africa.
And that, so that meant...
Aye. I mean, for example, there was a case there where a couple of national... I'll show you how strict it was. A couple of national servicemen got drunk once in Angola, and some of them wore priest's garments that was actually looted from
a mission show.
A mission, yeah. And... those kids were, I mean, there was no messing about. They were flown straight out and put in jail.
Really?
You know, I mean, the Afrikaner was strict.
Yeah. What was the case that was about 1981 that they got some Africans and they threw them on a bonfire and all this sort of thing? Oh, they're captured.
No.
And the blokes were had up for it.
I don't recall it.
So what happened then in Rhodesia?
Well, in Rhodesia, if the troops on the ground, you know, read a situation, the utmost backing from it, which led to excesses, and you know, the people were put down as, you know, running with terrorists, you know, and what they could have been is people who were in the local area. And the other thing was, they came up, there was at one stage went through this punitive action. If there was a contact within half a mile of a village, you could burn the village.
Right.
So, a person could keep contacts going all day and burn all the villages they wanted, you know, and this is the thing. So, you know, soldiers are like anybody else. It's a discipline that maintains them, and it's got to be firm.
What about the Rhodesian special branch and so forth? I mean, how did that work, following the troops and prisoners
one of the things
anybody they bumped into?
Yeah. Well, you've got to understand here, the original Rhodesian special branch, you know, were you know, highly specialised people, and they were good. They were good. What happened is the war picked up. They started bringing people in attachments, and this is where the standards actually fell. I cannot actually say I met a bad professional special branch man. I think the problem lay when they started bringing in other chaps to help them out.
Who were they?
They were chaps who were just put in an area, and they were...
But they were policemen?
They were policemen, yeah.
Policemen, but drafted into special branch.
Yeah, yeah. And you know... You know, I witnessed an interrogation by one day, and in actual fact, he was beating the answers he wanted out of the prisoner. Now, you know, what I'm actually saying here is a special branch man, one of the old pros, would have sat down and spoke to the guy and, you know, handed him on to another chap, and then come up with the answers. Whereas this chap was saying, this is what I want to hear, and beat it out of the chap. The chap told him what he wanted to hear. But, you know, it was me that had to go out and do the job on the ground looking for these fictitious gooks that he'd sort of beaten the information out of the chap.
Yeah. What else did they do to them?
There was a lot of... see, what you've got to understand here, let me put this right first. Rhodesia was in its death throes. All she was trying to do was save a country that was actually in the process of collapse. There was the use of poisons.
Really?
You know,
how did that work?
Well, exactly the same as it did with the British in Malaya.
Well, they used to poison wells.
Yeah, not like the terrorists had this habit of breaking into shops and the tribal trust lands, and they'd poison the coke. There'd be cases of poisoned coke there, and you go the next day and there'd be a few of them lying dead. They would booby trap certain things, like they were always getting their hands in radios. They'd leave a radio there and booby trap the radio, and you know, I mean, this has been done in other places.
Mm.
It wasn't just unique to Rhodesia. But what I actually noticed towards the end there, it was breaking down. The system was falling apart.
Mm.
towards the end, and you know, I think with it, people's patience went. Mm. Whereas when they saw themselves winning the war, they tended to be more patient.
Okay. Well, did the special branch actually go around with the troops?
No, what happened, they would come and give you a briefing. But in each army unit, there was a heavy, you had what was called a JOC, Joint Operations Command. Mm. And there would be special branch including it. So they collated the information, handed it on to the army, and it was a good system.
Yeah, so who did you have? You had the special branch, really, were the intelligence.
The intelligence,
I mean,
chaps.
they weren't intelligence anyway, but they did the military intelligence bit.
No, you had military intelligence, who sort of collated the military stuff, but the actual information on terrorists and, you know, how a tribal trust land operated, and, you know, who was operating in the area, that all came from
the
special branch.
So what was the demarcation between military intelligence and...
Well, your military guys would just... Take the military side of it and aid the chaps in it. Most of the briefings that I had, you've got to understand that I was with special forces. Mm. And most of our briefings came from special branch sources. So, you know, there was heavy liaison with them.
Right.
And they were included in everything.
Right. Okay. Okay, let's move on a bit. One thing I was going to ask was, did you have any, out of all these sort of various equipment and weapons, etc., that you used, did you have any most favourite and least favourite bits of kit?
In Rhodesia, we did everything with nothing. I mean, most of the weapons we used came from the actual terrorist. So if we were operating, say, blackened up, say in the Mozambique or Zambia or Botswana, we'd carry AK-47s. Mm. And the great thing about the AK-47, we always had the edge on the terrorists, so consequently there was never a shortage of ammunition. So, as we killed anybody, we were resupplying ourselves with ammo. Whereas if you were doing an external op, which was, say, a camp attack, you tended to carry FNs and not blacking up, you'd be white, so as other people could recognise you.
Right. Or just light camouflage.
No, we didn't.
No, it was camouflage.
It was white, yeah.
Really?
Mm. Yeah.
Right.
And there was no breakup. You know, people have often asked me that, but... That's what I'm telling you.
No camouflage.
You'd have thought maybe camouflage identification badge, light camouflage, anything. Right. But we were just totally white when we did it.
Right.
Mm. And it was FNs. In South Africa, I really enjoyed the Galil rifle.
Really? Know?
Well, we had a 50-round mag on it for starters.
A drum mag?
No, a big banana clip.
Really?
Mm. You had one panic mag and then you had 6 .35s.
The panic mag is the 50?
The 50, yeah.
Right.
That's what it was just what it was called.
I know Galil was rejected from the British Army because of its stoppage rate.
No,
which I like of reliability. I mean, that's the reason. Given.
Right, the ones
for NATO service.
Right.
Yeah.
What happened is we had Galils originally, and then they made the R4.
Yes.
And what it did is the problem with the R4 was they were
is the South African
version of the Galil. Yeah.
But how is that actually? It's just longer. It's longer butt, isn't it, Lars?
No, it's say you get different types. You get the R4 and the R5. One is a shorter version of it, and the other one's got a bipod plus a folding butt.
Mm. How does that differ from the Galil, the Israeli Galil?
Nothing.
No. Okay.
You'll find that the furniture on the R4 is plastic, whereas on the Galil it was wood.
Right.
And I had a Galil at first, a proper Galil, and it was terrific. And most of the guys liked the Galil. Then we got the R4. And there was some mistake in the specs. There was a different mix in the alloys to the actual Israeli one, and we tended to get stoppages and double feeds. And this resulted in, I mean, I actually had to get into hand-to-hand fighting due to a stoppage. I went to shoot the chap, and I had a double feed on it, and I finished up, you know, actually beating him from me with my rifle. You know, that's how bad it got. Yeah.
I mean, there's just a stoppage that, I mean, it wouldn't feed or it would misfeed.
No, it double fed. Yeah.
Really? But you found the actual Galil good, was it? Was it heavier, was it? Or?
It was heavier, and it was an infantryman's weapon. Mm. Whereas, you know, I look at other things, and it had all the qualities of the AK-47, plus the fact extra. I mean, you could put the safety catch from both sides. You had a 5.56 round in it, which was a good round, and I can only say that my experience with it was good. As I say, with the R4, once they ironed out the teething problems, you know, I believe it came right.
Right. Well, did you like the? What did you think of the AK generally?
The AK-47. I've never had one malfunction on me. Oh. And as I say, I used Romanian ones. I used Czechoslovakian ones. I used the AMD, which is a short version of it. And I can understand it. Why it's been used in so many revolutions. Right. It's soldier proof, you know.
Yeah. What about pistols and submachine guns and so forth?
As I say, the AMD is a version of the, is a submachine gun version of the AK-47. Mm. The only thing about it was cut straight back until you got to the gas, just after the gas port. Mm. So it tended not to sound like an AK when you fired. It was more like a 12-7. The pistols is, when I was with a special branch, I carried a Tokarov, which I thought was a lovely round, but we were issued with either Berettas or Browning Hypers, you know.
Mm. What, 9mm?
Yes, yeah.
Parabellum Berettas?
Yes, yeah.
Right, did you like those, or?
Oh, yeah, there was a heavy magazine capacity on them. You could get a 17-round mag.
Yeah. When you were in Angola, what pistol did you have?
Let me see. No, we had Stars up there.
Stars, Spanish Stars, nine mil.
Yeah.
Did you like those? Or?
No, I didn't. No.
Why not?
Well, you know, your magazine capacity was too small.
Seven.
And the other thing is I took some guys on a close quarter battle course with them, and they were just blown apart. I mean, the Star was a weapon that was used for somebody for, you know, defending his home. You put a magazine on it and put it in a drawer, and if someone, you know, you feel threatened in any way, you take the pistol out. But it couldn't be used, and you couldn't fight all day with a Star. It'd just blow apart. Yeah, the ones that we had, anyway.
Probably with machine gun ammunition.
Yeah.
Okay. What about Uzis and things like that?
Right, the submachine gun that we used was the Uzi. Mm. And that's a weapon I never liked. I found it too heavy for what it was. And I never reckoned on the thing. It was, you know, it was totally
controllable, uncontrollable.
I'm not used to a grip safety. It's got a grip safety on it, and you know, to me, to go through three different forms of safety to fire a weapon just takes too long, you know.
Right. Yeah. There's Armalites.
There was some Armalites about there in the South African Army, but not many. They were mainly special forces.
Did you like them all?
Oh, I've always been a M16 man, you know.
Right. Okay.
You know the Armalite, you know the M16A1. Once I got to the M16A2, they had a lot of the problems solved, you know.
Yeah. So you prefer the A2, do you?
A2. Yeah. You know, the bolt assist on it.
Yeah. On the side. Have you tried at all this SA-80, the British weapon now?
No. What I've done is I've spoke to an awful lot of soldiers on it, and they reckon the thing. It's an accurate weapon. It's just a lot of the points haven't been ironed out on it yet. And, you know, things like, you know, you can knock the side of your magazine catch and lose your magazine. But, you know, not one of the soldiers has actually complained about the accuracy of the thing. Mm. It's always to do with the mechanism and the unsturdiness of it, you know.
Okay. Yeah. Lack of, not robust.
Yeah.
I just think the FN you used in Rhodesia and South Africa.
Yeah.
And G3, presumably?
G3
How did
well.
You find each of those there?
Right, the FN, what I've always found about the FN is, although you've got an automatic capability on it, the actual change lever on it, it was hard to operate it with your thumb, so you had to bring your other hand in to do it, whereas on a British one, the idea thing was to get an FN with a British change lever on it.
Oh, right.
Because it could be operated with one hand.
Right.
Whereas with the FN, you had it there.
Did they actually make an adaption?
No, they didn't. No. They didn't. And the other thing was in the FN you got a fixed cocking handle, whereas with the Brits, it's sort of folded forward after it. And we had in the South African Defence Force, we had.
So it actually comes back with the quite near to your face, effectively.
No, it stops forward when it goes forward, but when you cock it, it's sticking out there the whole time, and you know.
All right.
It wouldn't have suited the Brigade of the Guards because when you do drill with it, it's sticking out and it tends to catch in things, you know.
Right.
But we had the parachute version of the FN.
The collapsible stock.
Yeah, it was a nice weapon, right. and the barrel was a bit shorter as well.
How did you find that firing? It's a pretty powerful round to fire fully automatic. Huh?
Oh yeah. The you know what you could do is get away with a short control burst, but you tended to get national service and territorial guys, and all they wanted to do was they'd sort of hold it overhand like that and fire it, you know. And it was never meant to do that. It was meant for a short burst, and that's it. But
how accurate? Up to what range would you say it was accurate? Well, hitting a figure target with a burst.
You start losing. You know, I've seen guys fire and burst at 25 meters and maybe have one round on the target and two off, you know. So you know, there's an awful lot to be said for, you know, semi-automatic, you know.
Right. What about
the G3?
Well, yeah, briefly, the G3.
The G3, in actual fact, I did quite a bit on the G3, and I was never actually comfortable with it. Mm. It was, you had this roller action, much the same as roller locks. And when you stripped the weapon, you know, at times you could have trouble putting the working parts back in. And what you actually had to do was reverse them, put them down to lock the rollers again, and then pull it back out and put it in. And I found this, you know, to be a fault with it.
Right.
You know, and they didn't like you putting it in backwards to knock the actual rollers back in. But, you know, the other thing was messing about and turning the working parts round to get the right angle so as the rollers would clip home again.
Uh-huh.
It was, in actual fact, it was much the same as the Dezhnev action in the Russian weapons, you know, the RPD, and the difference being rollers instead of sort of plates coming out the side.
Aha, uh-huh, okay. I was meaning to ask you, what about a Stirling, SMG?
We never used them out there at all.
In the British Army?
In the British Army, we used the Stirling.
What do you think of that?
I like the Stirling, yeah.
Uh-huh. Right, the G3 was said to rattle and... In Rhodesia, they didn't like it.
The other thing was, is the aluminium magazines and national servicemen were forever opening bottles of Coke with them.
Mm.
And, you know, the next thing you'd have is a ruined magazine. And the magazines for the G3 weren't as robust as they could have been. Interesting thing in Rhodesia, the parts of a lot of the weapons there, the actual working parts were actually bought. And the weapons... The actual body of the weapon was bought somewhere else, and they were fitted together. It was because you had your sanctions on.
Right.
Like, I had a Bren gun that actually came from three different countries, you know.
What was they got the idea, the craze of painting all the weapons in Rhodesia. How did that work? I mean, was it worthwhile?
Yes, it definitely was worthwhile. You know, and nothing was actually lost through it. In Rhodesia, we tended to paint camouflage, and it was actually illustrated. I mean, you go through the bush, there is nothing in the bush that is shiny black.
No.
There is when you have maybe street fighting, and it could blend in there, but in the bush it usually stick out, and it would give you away.
Mm-hmm.
So we tended to paint them, but as long as your working parts and that were clean, the weapons always functioned.
Right.
I never knew one to malfunction through having been painted.
Right.
And the South Africans, what they did, they actually done them in South African, brown colour they do them. And it was done professionally.
Over brown parkerizing.
Yeah. And that, you know, it was dull as well. There was no shine came off it.
Right. Okay. There's just one thing with both these countries that, I mean, to me, I've been there in the armed forces, likely being killed, injured, or captured, or whatever it might be. I mean, you'd essentially be doing it for somebody else that wasn't your own country. And how did you feel about that?
I've often thought about it, and you know, I was a professional soldier. I was an adventurer, you know, and I took what went with it. I mean, I can always see the Africans' point of view. I had nothing in particular against them. All I know that is, you know, we're playing a big boys' game, And a lot of occasions he wasn't actually told the truth by the people who were guiding him.
Right.
So you tend to, you know, they were going to build a better country for these people, and you know they're all going to be better off at the end of it. And when they actually got the countries, they weren't really better off. They had freedom. But as I say, in a lot of cases you can't eat freedom. You can't eat it.
Mm.
You know, which is what the working class of those countries,
you
know, what it was all about.
Mm. Okay, so you. From the adventure point of view, that's sort of marked off against the fact that you're here. But how did you? What did you? How did you find the Africans? And how do you feel about the Africans? How do you get on with them?
In Rhodesia, I found the African people extremely polite. Mm. And, especially the older Africans, they were actually lovely people. I think what happened there is you get the politicians came along, and there was an awful lot of rubbish getting poured into them from the black politician, what the end result was going to be. And it resulted in the death of, say, 35,000 Africans. Mm. I felt a bit sorry for them because they were lied to about their capacity to fight. They were lied about their, about certain motivations for doing what they were actually doing. In actual fact, I feel, and this is a personal thing, that they were there just to put people in power. Those people never particularly felt anything for those guys, you know. And I used to see them, it was sometimes pitiful that, you know, the casualties that we could inflict upon them, you know. Mm-hmm. And, especially when you were professional units like the Salu Scouts, SAS, and RLI, mm-hmm. we used to take them apart.
Mm-hmm. Did you find any, we're talking about the people in Angola, mm-hmm. Different tribes mm-hmm. in Rhodesia, and you're talking about the different people in Swapo and so forth. Did you find any? What were the two questions? Firstly, on fighting ability.
Yeah. Like there was once, the Mashona in Rhodesia. There was never a great problem with them. Once we came up against some Indibeli, or Matabele, they were actually shouting. They were actually trained as regular soldiers, so they were saying, come on, let's have it. And, they gave to us as good as they took, everything was weighed against them. But, if they'd have been trained as terrorists, they would have taken off and lived to fight another day. But they actually stood the ground and we had to kill every one of them. Mm. There were 78 of them, and they gave us a good run for our money. Mm.
Did you get any casualties on that occasion?
We had one killed, one wounded. Mm. But what you've got to understand here is we levelled them with gunships.
Huh, right.
So when we talk about that, they were being fired on from the sky
right.
and attacked on the ground. So the advantages lay with us.
Right. And what about the different? We've touched it slightly, but the fighting ability and discipline, whatever it might be, of the different African troops that have been fighting in your own side. Talking about the Colored Corps. We mentioned the people who were fighting on behalf of the South Africans.
Yeah. In Rhodesia, the Rhodesian African Rifles they were good troops. Mm. But, they're probably the better troops in Africa at that time.
Yeah. How can you describe?
They had an awful lot of tradition. See, the old Rhodesian African Rifles, I think they came from the KAR, the King's African Rifles. Mm. And there was tradition there. You're talking about a year's training with these guys. They're really beaten into them. And they did sort of white leadership and black leadership. And a lot of things that happened in those battalions, if a man was punished, he'd be punished by the black sergeant major, who wouldn't necessarily put him on jankers. Can you see that? He'd take a shamble to him. This was part of their tradition.
Yeah.
In South Africa, where they had the 32 battalion, in actual fact, what they had was a 50-gallon drum. And the troops bent over the drum, and they were actually birched by the RSM. The African troops. Now, what you've got to understand is the discipline there was probably similar to what it was in the British Army in the 19th century. We whipped chaps. Yeah. Not to say that the African was backward. It was that discipline was in its early stages there.
Yeah.
Because some of those African troops, especially the Rhodesian African Rifles, they were good. And in the case of 32 Battalion, they had real good, hardcore South African leadership, which made it was one of the elite battalions in the army.
What happened to the Rhodesian African Rifles? What happened to them after independence?
They were taken into the National Army, the Rhodesian National Army, yeah. And they functioned fairly well,
Right. Did you have any experience of the? Wasn't it called the 5th Brigade, or the?
No.
Were they formed up or?
No, they were.
That was after independence.
No, it was after independence. I stayed there for a bit.
The Korean 5th Brigade.
Yeah, and they were trained up at a place called Inyanga.
Mm-hmm.
And in actual fact, it was the normal communist claptrap you get. You know, the The majority of the training was based on motivation. You know, they couldn't necessarily back up their slogans, but you know, the fact is they were probably political troops as opposed to professional soldiers.
Yeah, I think they were.
Yeah, involved. I mean, they were used extensively against the Matabele.
Mm. I think they shot up quite a few. There were several instances where British or Western tourists had been shot up after independence by these people. They disappeared.
Something happened up at the Wanky area. I wouldn't like to elaborate on it. I just remember reading about it.
Yeah, and they eventually found the bodies a year later or something.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to Coyne. You got out of the army, and what happened? What did you do then? You got a married quarter, which presumably you had to relinquish.
Yes, and I moved into a civilian house.
Yeah, well, in
it was a company house in a place called Jan Niemann's Park
in
Pretoria.
In Pretoria,
yeah,
right.
And I then it was a totally Afrikaner area.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is
did many speak English?
No, they didn't. Honestly, this is... I took my son to the Afrikaans creche here. You know, and I always got on well with the Afrikaner. You know, a lot of English people can say here, but I understood them, you know. And because I understood the history. But there was a creche here. It was an Afrikaner creche. And I took my son there. He was only 2 and a half. And he came back crying. He says, there's no words, you know. And what he was saying was, I can't understand them. Within about just over a year, he was totally fluent in Afrikaans, you know. And I was injured after my parachute accident. I was laying in my bed and I could hear my son. I didn't know it was my son. I could just hear this fluent Afrikaans. I said, that sounds like Billy. And I got up and I wedged the pillows between my back and I sat up. And he was with these little Afrikaners. Kids, and he was telling them a story about me. And he going, my paw, you know. And actually, you know, I can understand Afrikaans between, you know, certain words are like Scottish words, and I did a little course on it. So between intonation of the voice and words I could understand, I could always pick up the gist of the conversation. And as I say, I went there, but there were things like... everybody had chickens in their back garden, sort of thing. You know, you'd hear these things crowing, especially out of tune. And there were lovely people. And my wife, Jane, had an awful lot of standing within the community there because she was a nurse. You know, if there's a problem with any of the kids, would come over and see her. And Jane was always helping.
She was working in one of the hospitals in Pretoria, was she?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm. Can you just go over things like... Yeah. I mean, did they wear shoes, the Afrikaner?
No, they didn't. The kids would go to school in the morning, and they'd be in their bare feet carrying their shoes. And my son, I mean, he just ran about in his bare feet.
But that would be in a school uniform.
They'd have a good school uniform. They had a school uniform on, a pair of sandals for them, and you see them walking down in their bare feet. They were comfortable like that. Yeah. And they were hardy kids, you know. It was surprising when you seen it. But you know
that was all of them, was it?
No, the majority.
Aye,
and as I say, my son ran about with no shoes on. He was comfortable like that.
But living next door to them, I mean, what did they? Early to bed, early to rise, no partying, getting drunk and throwing up over the balcony.
You never got that. But I remember once I.
And they're very strict. Could you explain how straight-laced they were?
No, they were fairly conservative people. Yeah. And, you know, they were a strong church-going community as well. But, you'd Afrikaners who drank and, you know, did a little bit of partying. But I remember once I had a party and I, you know, put these little sheets of paper through the people's doors, apologising should anything happen. You know, I explained it was a parachute regiment parabike reunion. And... you know, there might be some singing, you know, could they excuse it beforehand, and, you know, and the party sort of went on for 3 days, you know, and the actual fact is, there was no complaint. I never had any problems off my neighbours. There was never any arguing there. In fact, I enjoyed Jan Niemann's Park.
Right.
And there was always people coming and going from my house at the same time as well.
Yeah. But some of them were very... strict, there only tea and who's coffee Coffee is the strongest thing they drank.
And the, you know, sort of, if you wore a suit any lighter than dark grey, you were excommunicated from the church, you know. They had these, you know, staunchly, you know, very Calvinistic beliefs, you know.
But, I mean, compared to the English, they're very, very well turned out. I mean,
when they go to church, I mean, you know, like, to an English person who goes to church to worship God, with the Afrikaners, it's the social pressures on them as well. Can you see that? They go there, they always got a suit on when they go to church, and it's taken very seriously. You know, for a person like myself, it sort of took the fun out of religion, you know.
What sort of professions were they in, these chaps, people, families?
Well, you got to understand that being white, you know, we always held jobs in managerial levels, you know. Not necessarily because we had qualifications, probably a lot to do with the colour of the skin.
Sure. I think, just excuse me.
Yeah.